You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study shows that less than 1% of Wisconsin prison sentences in 2019 were due only to marijuana-related offenses. We'll look at the numbers and what they mean for the debate over legalization. Now, the Biden administration is weighing its options on withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan. In early 2020, former President Trump reached a deal with the Taliban for U.S. troops to begin leaving on May 1st of this year. President Biden said in an interview with ABC News last week that May 1st may be a little too optimistic.
I'm in the process of making that decision now as to when they'll leave. The fact is that that was not a very solidly negotiated deal that the former president worked out. And so we're in consultation with our allies as well as the government, and that decision's going to be, it's in process now.
Likely to take longer?
I don't think a lot longer.
U.S. troops have been in Afghanistan for nearly 20 years. In a surprise visit to Afghanistan over the weekend, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin refused to say whether the Taliban is holding up its end of the bargain. The war is just one of many foreign policy items that the Biden administration is dealing with. Others include China, North Korea, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? What are you seeing about the Biden administration's foreign policy? That's 800-642-1234. Our guest is Bruce Gentleson. He's the William Preston Few Distinguished Professor of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science at Duke University. He's also a former U.S. State Department official in the Obama and Clinton administrations. Bruce, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Biden's been in office for 61 days. What have we learned about his administration's approach to foreign policy matters, or is it really too soon to tell?
Yeah, in a number of respects, he's gotten off to a really good start. One of his first priorities was to stop the bleeding in relations with America's allies, particularly in Europe and Asia. You know, allies are a force multiplier. They're not like a favor we're doing for other countries around the world. And so in early February, it's a conference he normally would have gone to, but didn't go to because of COVID. He gave a big speech to a conference in Munich, Germany. And he just sent his top foreign policy people to Asia. And they were in South Korea and in Japan and India, as well as meeting with China. And it was really important to say America believes that our security is enhanced by working with others. We're not going to go it alone. And the other quick priority was to stand up to Putin. Still don't know all the details of Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's relationship, but it was pretty clear whether it was on human rights issues or Ukraine or interference in American elections that Trump was basically letting Putin have his way. And Biden has already sent a message. They've talked directly that we're not going to turn him into a total adversary. Biden actually already renewed a major strategic arms nuclear treaty with them. But we really need to make clear that we have our interests and we're going to take stands on them.
And we'll certainly travel around the world to talk about this. But you just mentioned former President Donald Trump. How does what President Joe Biden is doing stack up with what we've seen for the past 4 years?
Well, the message from Donald Trump to America's allies was, we don't care about you. We think you've been using us. And very much in your face, including at a personal level with a lot of the leaders. The alliances we have served us well for 40, 50, 60 years. They need to be recalibrated and adjusted as the world changes, for sure. But they're based on a mutuality that, whether it's in relation to Russia or in relation to China or in many other ways. I mean, for example, the meeting of what they call the Quad, the four democracies in Asia, Australia, Japan, South Korea, India, and ourselves. It was very interesting. Like, they didn't just stress standing up to China. They said, let's get together for COVID vaccine distribution in the region, and let's get together to try to develop some of the common climate change policies. And those are ways in which 1 and 1 equals 3. You know, you get more done when you work with others. Very, very different than the message that Trump was saying and the policies he was pursuing.
Bruce Gentleson's a professor of public policy and a professor of political science at Duke University. And as we have this conversation, you are part of it. Call 800-642-1234. What are your early impressions of President Biden's foreign policies? What do you think about one area or another as we talk about Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Russia, China? Call in at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff from Superior on the line. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, these professors you have on represent the Democratic Party, and the Democrats have no credibility when it comes to foreign policy. When you look at Clinton and Kerry and Gore, and Obama had 8 years in the White House, he had the opportunity to take the troops out of Afghanistan, but he never did. He drew a red line in the sand in Syria, and he didn't enforce it. The Democrats have no plan. They've never had a plan from the beginning. The only one who did was Donald Trump, and he had over 70 million, almost 80 million people vote for him, the most of any sitting incumbent president in United States history. So there are Americans out there who believe Trump had the right idea to go it alone, and we are not, cahoots with Russia. Russia is a first world nation. We are working with them. We're the two strongest nations on earth. And the policy of appeasement that Trump had with China and Russia was working.
All right, Jeff, I'm going to jump in here because you've made a couple of different points here, and I want to make sure that our guest, Bruce Gentleson, has the ability to respond there. Jeff's point, Bruce, that I heard front and center at the beginning was Jeff doesn't think Democrats have a plan.
Well, you know, I know that I respect Jeff's view, and a lot of people did vote for Donald Trump. More people obviously voted for Joe Biden. Democrats have had a lot of successes on foreign policy. It was Democrats that, even going back to Jimmy Carter, who people, you know, don't take very seriously, made the first major peace treaty between Israel and an Arab country, Egypt. Bill Clinton made one between Israel and Jordan. Nothing else like that had been achieved in the Middle East by any Republican president. On Afghanistan, though, I think he has a point there. I think it's very important. We have a war there that has been going on for almost 20 years. That has spanned, you know, one administration after another, Republican and Democrat. It's often referred to as the forever war. We can't have forever wars. And it really is time to end that war, but to end it with a strategy. And I think that's what President Biden is working on. Donald Trump was, oh, let's just get out, and, you know, because I think that'll help me politically. I'm not sure that really stands up very well as a solid foreign policy doctrine.
Well, Bruce, Jeff mentioned Russia. You've already mentioned Russia. So let's talk about that. In his interview with ABC last week, Biden was talking about Russia and said he and Vladimir Putin might not be close friends, but they understand each other. And then he said this, which generated some headlines.
Look, most important thing dealing with foreign leaders, in my experience, and I've dealt with an awful lot of them over my career, is just know the other guy.
So you know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly.
Okay. So President Biden is talking about something there. But first off, what do you make of Biden saying he thinks Putin is a killer?
Yeah, there's some truth to it. I don't think it was the best idea to go say it. You know, we've long known Joe Biden occasionally, you know, makes some gaffes and stuff. But the fundamental issue, I think, is that Vladimir Putin, you know, had interfered in American elections in 2016, 2020, had supervised and executed this huge hack on American computer systems in the private sector and in the public sector that Trump paid no attention to. They were just beginning to get a handle on. And I think Putin does understand Biden. It was very significant that even though he was sending Putin a tough message, that right away they agreed to the renewal of the Strategic Nuclear Arms Control Treaty. Why? Because it's in both our interests not to get into another nuclear arms race and spend all that money on that and risk a nuclear war. So I think you're going to see a strategy that will work much more effectively than, frankly, giving Putin close to a blank check, as happened in the Trump years.
Do we have any idea what kind of price Biden might be talking about?
You know, I think his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, indicated that some of the things we'll see, like the sanctions they announced dealing with Alexei Navalny, the dissident that they first tried to poison and then threw in jail. And others, you know, are better not talked about, right? If there is some cyber efforts going on, Putin will know about them. And as it's often said in foreign policy and also in life, if you're successful, you don't have to talk about it or brag about it. I think that's what he was indicating. There'll be things that we do that send a message that we won't necessarily get up and tell the press about, because the important thing is that Putin sees what we're doing and gets the message and starts to talk in a serious way to us about areas we might be able to work together.
We're looking at U.S. foreign policy under the Biden administration with Bruce Gentleson. He's a former U.S. State Department official in the Obama and Clinton administrations. He's also a professor of public policy and of political science at Duke University. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about President Biden's approach to foreign policy so far? Which issue are you most concerned about? Where do you think he's getting things right? Other areas you don't think he's doing so well? Just talking about Russia, we'll talk about Afghanistan up next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got more on U.S. foreign policy and how it affects us still ahead on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. We are taking a look at the Biden administration's handling of various foreign policy issues, including China, Russia, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, and climate change even. Bruce Gentleson is our guest. He's a professor of public policy and of political science at Duke University. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and we're taking your calls. You can let us know what you think of the foreign policy measures taken by President Biden by calling 800-642-1234. Tell us which issue you find most urgent or what you'd like to see the administration do about some things facing the United States. That's 800-642-1234. Your calls are always welcome here on the Ideas Network. Bruce, we need to talk about Afghanistan because so much has happened recently. And those specific issues, Biden campaigned on ending what he called forever wars there and in the Middle East. So back to that May 1st deadline about withdrawing troops. How important is that?
It's very important. The deadline itself is not important, but it's very important to make a firm commitment to withdraw troops. And to also set up a strategy for negotiations for getting out. Biden inherited a deal that, as he said, wasn't all that well negotiated, number one. And number two, moving out America, that many American troops and all the equipment takes a lot of preparation, and very little, if any, of that was done by the Trump administration. I do believe that we shouldn't waffle on this. What I'm waiting to hear from the president is that if it's not May 1st, what's the deadline that it's going to be? And it needs to be a deadline definitely within this calendar year, if not by, let's just say, August. But at the same time, it's not just about getting out. And one of the interesting things that the administration has done is it started a negotiating process with all the countries in the region, China, Russia, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, India, Iran, basically saying, you know, in some respects, having American troops there has actually helped all those countries with the different groups that they want to support. And we've been there trying to keep the stability and security while they could kind of do whatever they wanted to do. And now it's time for all the countries to understand that we're not going to protect their interests anymore, and that they're going to have to figure out a way to everybody work together. You're not going to make Afghanistan a perfectly stable place, but you can keep it from becoming a haven for terrorists. The Taliban should have learned the lesson by now after 20 some odd years that if they invite al-Qaeda back in, they would pay a price again. So those are the things you have to work on to make it work. But May 1st was the deadline that was inherited. It wasn't as if President Biden said May 1st was his and then he had to change it himself.
We've got Kurt in Milton who wants to join the conversation. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I look at a broad range of things, and I think that may be the case that there are a lot of instances of information being withheld from the public and things like that that don't come out that are really influencing the decisions. I've noticed over the years that multiple presidents have wanted to shut down our activities in Afghanistan. Multiple administrations have wanted to shut down Guantanamo Bay. But once they get into the position and once they know the classified information, something changes. One of the things I will just mention is people don't know, but to make a nuclear weapon in today's society, you don't use enriched uranium. You use plutonium, which gets made from a power reactor set up as a breeder reactor, but you need lithium. And that's one of the key things that may be only available or kind of only available in Afghanistan. So we may be doing things like protecting our lithium access.
Kurt, thank you so much for bringing that up. I want to make sure that Bruce has a chance to respond to the idea that people campaign on getting out of Afghanistan, on closing down Guantanamo Bay, and then they don't do it.
Yeah, Guantanamo in the Obama administration wasn't done largely because of politics. The Obama's efforts to do it ran into Republican opposition. It wasn't sort of a conspiracy or secret information. I think it's a fair criticism in 2009 that when the Obama administration was considering Afghanistan, he'd actually campaigned to end the war in Iraq, but he believed he could do better in Afghanistan, and they kept the war going. And now we're further into it. I would say, you know, that having been in government, there's sometimes people keep information secret that the American people really should know, and they often do it because if we knew, we wouldn't like it. But there are other times where it's really important. If you go back to when Henry Kissinger made the breakthrough in 1971-72 with China, those were secret talks. And if you think about it like a flower you keep in the greenhouse till it can go out into the climate. Similarly with the talks that made progress on Arab-Israeli peace in the early 1990s. So there are times in which quiet diplomacy really is important, and it's in the interest of the American people. And we should hold our leaders accountable, Joe Biden or anybody else, to keeping secret those kind of things that will lead to benefits to the American people, but not just to hide problems.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and a professor of political science at Duke University. And we are talking about U.S. foreign policy now 61 days into the Biden administration. And Bruce, we haven't yet talked about another foreign policy issue that takes us to Saudi Arabia. The U.S. says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave the order to have journalist Jamal Khashoggi killed. Biden declined to hand down any punishment, saying it's not U.S. policy to go after heads of state. He did say others were held accountable in Khashoggi's death. What message did Biden send with that response?
Yeah, now, here I'll be critical of the president and you know, party that I have been a part of. I think that was the wrong decision that he made. And I think it was wrong for a number of respects. One is our own intelligence demonstrated that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he likes to be called, had basically ordered and supervised not just the killing of a dissident, but the butchering of a dissident. Mm. And someone who was a resident of the United States and was a journalist affiliated with American newspapers. You know, that's of a caliber that there really need to be severe consequences if we're going to say we stand for human rights. But secondly, the argument that the administration made is, well, you know, it was a terrible thing, but we have these other issues with Saudi Arabia. No, I mean, to the extent that they cooperate with us on counterterrorism, it's not a favor to us. It's in their interest. They're more threatened by terrorists than we are. And I think you send the wrong message. You send the message that a leader like MBS or in Egypt, General Sisi, who's a dictator, might feel that all they have to do is say, oh, you know, we'll help you on counterterrorism. We can get away with things. So from a pure power and leverage perspective, as well as human rights, it was really the wrong decision.
And it was different than what Biden campaigned on. I mean, in the campaign, we heard him say that Saudi Arabia had no redeeming social value. And then this was the decision that he came down on, that the political cost was too high.
Yeah, I think they made a calculation that they were saying to MBS that they were telling him they would only deal with the king. He had to deal with our defense secretary because he was minister of defense. They were trying in some ways to you know, balance things out too much. And that's why I say it was not just that human rights should be respected, but also if you're just thinking pure power politics and leverage of who has leverage over whom, I think MBS came out of this thinking that he can get away with things. And that's a bad thing for American leverage and power in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Now, how would you describe our relationship with the Saudis?
You know, you go back to the early 1970s, where we were very dependent on them for oil. We're much less dependent now for a variety of reasons, whether it's our own oil and natural gas production, or we have a diversity of suppliers. We also for the right reasons, and doing a lot more on renewables. And climate change is a huge priority for this administration. It needs to be even more because it's affecting us here and now, not just at some point in the future. And the Saudis have done many things that have been in their own interest, not just ours. You know, for example, they kicked out Qatar from one of the regional alliances because they have a rivalry with them. And we have one of our major military bases in Qatar, right? And so with countries around the world, you have to say, here are common interests, we'll work together. And here, even if, you know, we're partners in some ways, if we have divergent interests, we're going to pursue our interests. You know, that's what our priority is, not just letting you get away with things because you're a friend to us on certain ways.
We can't cover all of Biden administration's foreign policy in this amount of time. But as we wrap up, what other foreign policy issue are you watching?
Climate change. I mean, this is such an issue. You know, there's something called the doomsday clock, which is a figurative thing that shows how close we are to doomsday. And it usually is based upon, you know, the state of nuclear weapons. Well, in January 2020, it got closer to midnight than ever before. And it was because of climate change, not just because of nuclear weapons. The economic consequences. I mean, right now you have Wall Street and major financial interests in the American economy that are saying, let's invest in climate change. The politics are changing, other than some denialists. You know, the Republican Party, a lot of Republicans want to do it. We're losing time. We don't have to just rejoin the Paris Agreement, but we have to ratchet up the goals for ourselves and others because it's an issue that affects everything in our society, at the local level to the national to the global.
Bruce, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and a professor of political science at Duke University. He's also a former U.S. State Department official in the Obama and Clinton administrations. And we talked with him about the Biden administration's approach to Russia in the Middle East and other foreign policy issues. Coming up, we look at the number of marijuana-only offenders sentenced to prison time in Wisconsin and what it means for the debate over legalization of marijuana. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about masks in the state legislature and remote accessibility for government meetings at various levels. Now, Governor Tony Evers' current state budget proposal included legalizing recreational marijuana. That's an idea Republicans in the legislature say they won't entertain. Evers and other supporters of legalizing pot say it would reduce unnecessary prison sentences and save money in the justice system, among other things. New research from the Badger Institute looked into just how many people in the state's prison system are sentenced for only marijuana-related offenses. And based on data from 2019, they make up a small share of Wisconsin prison sentences. Julie Grace is a policy analyst in the Badger Institute Center for Opportunity. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Keeley.
First, make sure we understand what we're talking about when we refer to the state prison system. It doesn't include county jails, right?
That is correct. Yep, we are only talking about, as you mentioned, prison admissions in 2019 for this study.
And what did you find when you looked at data from that year on marijuana convictions?
Sure. And so I want to be super clear about what the data is measuring and what it's not measuring. So we were interested in determining just how many people were sentenced to prison for only a marijuana-related offense. And so we kind of broke those down into three categories, possession with intent to deliver, and manufacture deliver. This data does not, however, include cases where perhaps there were a more serious charge. So we only looked at individuals who were sentenced to prison in 2019 who had one of those three or a combination of those three types of charges. And they happened to be sentenced to prison or jail. You know, they could have also gotten probation and those didn't show up. But as you mentioned previously, Keeley, we found that only 21 people actually were sentenced to Wisconsin State Prison in 2019 for only a marijuana-related offense or a combination of such offenses.
So 21 of the 9,128. So that's a pretty small number, I think, when you're looking at it overall percentage-wise. Now, county jails handle most sentences that are a year or less. And if that data is not part of the system, that information might be harder to find. So what were you able to find when dealing with county jails?
Sure. So when we're looking at jail data, which, as you mentioned, would be for a sentence of 1 year or less, we found that 651 people were sentenced to a county jail in 2019 for a marijuana-only offense. So obviously that number is much higher than the number of prison admissions for marijuana. However, unfortunately, because we do not have statewide jail data or jail admission data, it's difficult to compare how much that is compared to the total number of admissions. But all things considered, I mean, it's a relatively low number, we thought, based on just looking at how many people go to jail in Milwaukee, for instance, in a given year. And so it makes sense that the jail number is a little bit higher. But still relatively low, I would think, all things considered, when we're talking about marijuana offenses, which I think a lot of people think account for a wide or a large number of admissions to prison and jail. But we found that that's actually just not the case, and that many times perhaps people are going to jail or prison with a marijuana conviction on their record, but they might have also been convicted of a more serious crime as well.
How do sentences for marijuana offenses compare with harder drugs?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this is all not to say that the people in Wisconsin aren't going to prison for drug offenses. According to the Department of Corrections, actually 21% of all admissions in 2019, about 1,900 people were sentenced where their most serious charge was a drug offense. When you look at sentences where there just happened to be at least one drug charge, that number is even higher. That accounts for 31% of admissions, which is about 2,800 people. And so, you know, we did not look into what crimes those individuals are being sentenced for and charged with. However, we can deduce that those are probably for some of the harder, more serious drugs than marijuana.
One of the points made by proponents of legalizing marijuana, including Governor Evers, is that it would reduce costs in the criminal justice system. This conversation is happening in part because Governor Evers has proposed legalizing recreational pot. What are you hoping these numbers add to the conversation?
That's a great question. And I should say that we didn't really look into whether Governor Evers' policy or budget proposal was good policy or not. We just kind of wanted to get a snapshot of what's the current system look like? How many people are being sentenced for only marijuana-related offenses? But when you do kind of do back of the napkin type math, I guess, for just those 21 cases, the cost savings, at least to the state prison system, is really not that much. It would maybe come out to around like $1 million. But we did not attempt to calculate where the cost savings would come from other areas of the criminal justice system. So, you know, there may be additional savings to police departments or prosecutors or courtrooms, but, you know, since the number of people being sentenced and admitted for just marijuana offenses are so low to the state prison system, it's safe to assume that the cost savings would also be low as well.
Julie, thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julie Grace is a policy analyst in the Badger Institute Center for Opportunity, and she talked with us about data showing that fewer than 1% of state prison sentences in 2019 were related solely to marijuana offenses. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a regional snack.
Sarah Krause from Algoma wrote to our Wisconsin project and asked us, what is Matunke, the under-the-radar Czech snack eaten in northeastern Wisconsin? Good question, Sarah. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy had a Zoom cooking lesson with Sarah and her friend, Scott Prokash, to learn more about the treat and its origins.
What is it that makes Matunke so intriguing?
It's funny when somebody tries Matunke for the first time, they start chewing on it and they're like, what?
Why? If you don't tell them what's in it, right?
They're like, why am I eating this? But then they'll eat one and then all of a sudden they're back there having another piece going, oh, this is kind of intriguing, you know?
The ingredients are humble and somewhat predictable when you think about Czech food. There's sauerkraut, some flour, a little bit of salt, and then a healthy amount of cracklings. Or in other words, browned pork fat.
The best way to describe Matunke is to say it's interesting. It looks gray, like a cross between cardboard and oatmeal. It's kind of crisp and kind of doughy.
Vani Kanjerski is a master Matunke maker from Kewaunee. She's more straightforward in her description.
I just say it's like a flat sauerkraut cookie.
It's a simple recipe. Dump all of the ingredients into a bowl and then get your hands dirty with the mixing. Sarah and Scott show me how via Zoom.
So I would describe the consistency of mine right now is kind of like pie dough, a little bit sticky, but not too much. Oh yeah, it looks good. Mine's sort of similar.
Yeah.
Mine's a little messier.
Next, roll out the dough. You're aiming for a crispy but still slightly chewy texture. So roll it out to about a quarter inch, cut it, then bake it at 400 degrees for roughly 15 minutes.
It is a sticky mess. So you got to flour the heck out of everything.
Okay, more flour than you think you need.
Oh my God, the first time I made it, it was sticking to my rolling pin, my hands, my belly. I mean, I was in big trouble.
All right, doing the cutting. They aren't going to be pretty, but it is pretty satisfying to cut this with a pizza cutter.
That's a good move.
I don't think they had those in Czechoslovakia in 1800, but
I don't think so.
Sarah and Scott wanted to know about the origins of Matunke. And while I tried to do my research, I couldn't find a lot of information on the dish. In Wisconsin, it appears to be a fairly hyper-local food in the Kewaunee County area, where many Czech immigrants settled. Vani says it's classic farm cooking. They had the ingredients on hand, and nothing went to waste. If you do find the recipe written down, it's most likely in a local church cookbook.
And it's mostly like word of mouth. It's not going to be in the recipe books. I've even looked in old recipe books. I've not found it.
Matunke is a huge hit in Ronnie's family. And every summer, she makes 40 pans of it with her husband at the Czech Fest in Algoma.
Everybody just clamors over it. And it just disappears. It just flies off the bar counter right away.
At this point in my cooking lesson with Scott and Sarah, the kitchen is starting to smell phenomenal, and the Matunke has a nice golden brown color. To be clear, I love sauerkraut and have high expectations.
It smells so good.
Let's do it while it's warm, yeah.
All right, let's do it.
That's good.
Mm, mm-hmm. You got a good crisp on the bottom of these.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It takes a minute for, like, the sauerkraut flavor to set in, but it's good.
Do you think you'll bring this to like your next social gathering in 2022?
I think I will. I would make this again for sure. Really good.
Well, I wonder if you could take it to the next level with cheese in it.
Go ahead and add some cheese, or like Scott, sprinkle it with caraway seeds. Whatever sounds good to you. If you can't find cracklings, lard also works well as a substitute. And as Vani would say,
put some happy in that recipe.
Right.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on Matunke, a Czech snack found in northeastern Wisconsin. And that story idea came from an audience member as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up here on Central Time, we discuss state Republicans not requiring masks to be worn consistently for in-person legislative sessions or hearings and what that means for public access. That's next here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. It's the latest get-rich-quick scheme for the cryptosphere, brought to you by the letters NFT. Non-fungible tokens are fueling a new multi-million dollar mania for the digital art world. So what's going on? Jen White looks at behind the boom, plus the latest on the AstraZeneca vaccine and the FDA. Those stories today on 1A Plus. That starts at 6 o'clock. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Three out of four of the Wisconsin legislature's Joint Finance Committee's public hearings on the next state budget will be in person. A fourth will be virtual only, though people can stream all of them online. Lawmakers at the state capitol have also been inconsistent about enforcing mask wearing at in-person meetings and hearings. That's caused an outcry from some other representatives who've argued that forces people to choose between legislating and personal safety for themselves and for their families. Republicans say masks are highly encouraged and that choosing to wear one or not comes down to an individual's freedom to do what they think is right for them. And now the Wisconsin Department of Justice Office of Open Government re-upped its advisory from a year ago that government meetings in the state remain open and reasonably accessible to the public during the ongoing pandemic. For more discussion on these threads, Bill Leaders is our guest. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and editor of The Progressive magazine. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Keeley. It's good to be back.
Let's start with meeting accessibility. What do you make of this advisory reminder from the state attorney general's office?
Well, the attorney general said that COVID continues to present a danger for meetings that are held in person, particularly for certain individuals. And the attorney general advised that public bodies and the legislature should keep in mind the public health situation and the guidance of public health professionals and the concerns of the public when they're conducting themselves and making decisions about whether masks are required or whether people have the opportunity to attend remotely. The AG also strongly encouraged that people be able to attend remotely if there's a concern about going to a meeting in person for a health reason or for preference. The accommodation should be made that they can attend remotely. The problem is it sometimes isn't. We've had legislative committees meet in meetings that were not accessible remotely and in an environment where some of the members of the committee were not wearing masks. We've had objections to that were raised by a committee member who felt that she should not have to put her health at risk in order to do her job. I think that's a legitimate concern. I wish that the statement from their Attorney General Josh Call had gone farther and said that it is it's a violation of the open meetings law, which I believe it is, for public bodies to meet without providing some accommodation for remote attendance, especially if the members are so irresponsible that they are refusing to wear masks in an indoor public setting.
Yeah, it is an advisory, not a requirement. Wisconsin has an open meetings law. What should we know about how it does or maybe doesn't apply here?
Well, the open meetings law does say that members of committees should have the ability to attend the meetings of that committee. So to my mind, saying that you're going to have to step into an environment where your health may be put at danger is a violation of that. Also, the law says that reasonable accommodation must be made to members of the public to attend any public meeting. And if attending a public meeting means going into a closed environment where there are government officials and others who are not wearing masks because the committee doesn't require it, that to me, again, is a clear violation of the law. I wish people would just knock it off. You know, you can conduct yourself as you wish in your own world, but when you go out into the public and you represent the public as public officials, you should have enough responsibility to take reasonable precautions against transmitting this deadly disease.
Bill Leaders is president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and the editor of The Progressive magazine. And we're talking about this issue of reasonable accessibility when it comes to public meetings, public happenings, both for people who are involved, leaders, lawmakers, and also for the public. And Bill, we referenced public hearings on the budget that are scheduled for next week. But another big topic coming up is redistricting. How does this conversation we've been having about accessibility and safety for public participation carry forward to that process?
Well, I don't know that the COVID concern transfers directly. I will say, though, in terms of this issue about public meetings, it's not just the legislature. Some of the biggest violators of this have been local government officials. We had a story that was written in the State Journal in December about several government bodies in Wisconsin townships and so forth that were holding meetings without masks. There's a reporter, Karen Parker of an Oconto, Ontario, excuse me, paper who contracted COVID. She thinks from attending these public meetings as part of her job. She spent 4 days in the hospital. We had a situation more recently where three officials in Thiensville who were members of a historic preservation commission resigned their permission because the committee chair refused to hold meetings remotely, refused to allow even the 94-year-old committee chairman to attend remotely, said, you know, suck it up and come to our meeting where we don't wear masks or, you know, tough nuts. And three members of that committee resigned. So it's a problem in some areas more than others. It should be a problem in none. With regard to the issue of redistricting, that's also a very important transparency issue in Wisconsin. The last time that legislative redistricting was done under conditions of maximum secrecy. Lawmakers were allowed to see the maps of how their own districts were being redrawn in order to maximize partisan advantage. They had to sign a statement saying that they wouldn't talk about what it was that they saw. There were no public meetings. It was all done in secret. The process cost $3.5 million of taxpayer money. Now there's a new redistricting process that's about to start. Governor Tony Evers has proposed that it be done by a nonpartisan commission that would conduct itself in the open. Short of that, if the legislature is going to do the redistricting, he said, it should have open meetings. It should preserve all of the records from the redistricting process. Right now, lawmakers can, and in some cases do, destroy records at will if they think they're incriminating. The governor called in his budget for there to be a records retention rule of 10 years for redistricting records and for there to be an open and transparent redistricting process, which I think would serve everybody. The only reason the legislature wants to conduct things in secret is because it's trying to get away with things that it knows the public would be appalled by.
So what is the solution then when you are balancing the important work of redistricting or budget talks, any of that, with concerns that people have for their health, you know, with the issue of open government?
Well, I do think that the budget hearings are going to include an opportunity for people to participate remotely, which is mm-hmm. what should be done. All public bodies in Wisconsin, state and local, should be making that accommodation available. But it's another concern that that the meat of the process be done in the open, that you hear the discussions, you hear the rationale. Why are you carving up this district this way and not that way? Well, oftentimes it's because they are expressly trying to maximize partisan advantage so that they can win elections, even though they maybe don't have majority support. And that's just not a good rationale for secrecy. The public has a right to see a public policy being made. That's one of the fundamental tenets of Wisconsin government, and it's being violated. It was violated in the last redistricting process. Let's not do that again. Let's require that the legislature conduct the redistricting process in the light of day. Let people see what they're up to. Let people see the arguments that are made for the way that they go about this task.
In our last minute together, Bill, if someone is concerned that they don't have access or that the governing bodies aren't respecting open meetings laws, what do we do?
Well, I would hope that at some point the citizen, citizen or a member of a public body files a complaint alleging that their rights have been violated or that the open meetings law in particular has been violated by committees that refuse to make reasonable accommodation for remote attendance and who continue to meet in defiance of public health care, public health guidelines without a requirement that mask be worn. I think that it should be actionable. And I hope someone brings a complaint, and I hope a district attorney somewhere takes it seriously and prosecutes these public officials for their arrogance and callousness.
Bill, thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
Bill Leaders is president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and editor of the Progressive magazine. We talked with him about public hearing accessibility, including a lack of mask requirements and remote attendance at meetings of various levels of government. And tomorrow at 8 o'clock on The Morning Show, we learn how vaccine development and awareness factor into diplomacy. We're also talking about what contributes to the rise in infectious diseases, including anti-science movements. Join us tomorrow on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show airs weekdays from 6 to 9. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then in-person visits are returning to nursing homes. We talk about what COVID-19 has done to long-term care. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.